This is my journey, inspired one story at a time. A library of leaders was created. It began as a journey to learn. As time went on, it began to grow. All it needed was a platform, and this podcast was created to listen, to inspire, to share. I am a storyteller, and this is my journey. Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I'm your host, Steve Anderson, and today we just have a fascinating guest in Julie Heffaker. Julie and I have known each other for quite some time. She's just one of those people that I just love being around. Her wisdom, her thoughtfulness, her friendship, she's just an amazing person, and I can't wait to share her with you today. So sit back, listen to someone who's got tons of experience and a lot of wisdom, and I hope you enjoy this program as much as I will. Julie is the secret weapon, and yes, that is her real title, for deeper, funner change. She is a social scientist fascinated by how people come together in groups and outperform themselves. She has more than 25 years experience helping organizations deliberately evolve leadership, culture, strategy, and capacity. She has a PhD in organizational leadership and change. She has a master's in human development, and she also has an MBA. She has conducted groundbreaking research on how growth organizations can sustain their unique cultures and develop group genius. She is a senior faculty member at Banff Leadership Center and the Institute for Social Innovation Fellow at Fielding University, and a scholar with Moorhead Kane Foundation and a past Carnegie Fellow at Portland State. She is a principal and founding partner at consultancy Deeper, Funner Change. She helps leaders, teams, and organizations outperform themselves through the habits of group genius. She is also the author of numerous chapters and articles, including 4 books. Past works have been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and CNN. Julie lives in Portland, Oregon, is a passionate paddleboarder, and is enjoying her brand new puppy. Julie, welcome to the program. So excited to have you as a guest today.
Steve, you're one of my favorite human beings on the planet, and I am delighted to be here with you.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to this. Now, in my intro that I say for this program, I tell my guests and I claim that I'm a storyteller. With that in mind, I'm going to go ahead and tell a story to start this off, if you're okay with that, about the time you and I first met.
Oh, sure.
I was a young CEO, pretty young in my tenure, and I had this great idea that I wanted to create this leadership development program, and I had kind of a concept in my head. And a mutual friend of ours said, well, you need to talk to Julie. So I remember that you came up to Seattle and we sat down in my office and we just had a great discussion. I think we hit it off. We just were on the same wavelength and we're talking about all the possibilities. And I was so excited about where we were headed. And at the time, I was also a member of a mastermind networking group called Vistage. And so I went with the idea and the proposal to Vistage, and they looked at me and they said, Steve, why would you do this? Because this is what you do. You're a great leader and you can do this. So why would you bring somebody from the outside in to do this? And I let them talk me out of it. And so I didn't do it. But the reason I tell the story is because I knew it was right. I hung in there for 10 years. We didn't do it, but 10 years later, I called you up and I said, Julie, I want to do this. I want to go forward. And so we put it together. And from that, Hothouse Leadership Development Program was developed for Therapeutic Associates. And we went forward and, gosh, we've been doing that. You've been doing that now with the company for what? It's going on about 10 years, right? About 10 years?
That's right.
So anyway, I just tell that story because, gosh, I almost feel like I wasted 10 years and I could have been doing more. I mean, I obviously tried to do some of it myself and we did some good things, but we also had a few hiccups along the way. And then when you came in, it just really solidified what I think the possibilities are. So just right out of the gate, I just want to thank you for your contribution to that program and what a significant effect it had on the company that I was leading at the time.
I'm really humbled by that. Thank you. I mean, working with TAI over those years has just been one of the greatest joys. So thank you, Steve.
Oh, you're more than welcome. So, Julie, organizations have to change and how they do things. So why do you feel this is the way businesses should go? What do they have to change? What are they doing that they need to do better?
What an interesting way to phrase that question. I love it. You know, I think really it's getting clear now, because organizations are so interdependent with their customers and clients, with their vendors, with their suppliers, with other partners, even co-competitors in their ecosystems. We see how businesses are working within ecosystems, up and downstream. And the more the ecosystems change, the more the businesses themselves have to transform and adapt to keep pace and keep creating value for their clients and customers and partners. So we used to, you know, years ago, think of change as something that happened and then it froze for a period of time. There was a status quo and then change happened again. Now, most of us are talking about continuous change and the need for organizations to really organize themselves and for their people to be ready in every moment to be continuously adapting to the changes around them.
Now, you're the company that you co-founded and own and are a lead in today is called Deeper, Funner Change. So just kind of in a nutshell, tell our listeners, what is the organization and what are you trying to accomplish with your goals?
Sure. This is funny. If my mother were listening to this podcast, the first thing she would say is funner is not a word. She was an English teacher. but what we are working on is this. We really believe that the future belongs to organizations that are agile and innovative, and just like we were talking about, continuously able to adapt and change to changing circumstances around them and inside them. So what we have found in our work, and I've been consulting for a long time and I've made every mistake in the book, and part of what we found in our work was that lifting people up and taking them to an offsite and then plopping them back into the organizational environment did not a change make. So what we're up to is something a little different. I guess it aligns with the statement that most people are allergic to being told what to do. That's what traditional change making looks like. Those people who would lift it up and went to the offsite, come back and tell everybody else what they need to do. So people are allergic to being told what to do, but they wholeheartedly embrace what they've helped create. We're really interested in working with organizations both to learn how to co-create change. So they're engaging all levels of the organization in creating the way forward. It's not consensus, but collaborative intelligence or group genius. We know that groups can outperform the individuals within them, even the smartest ones, but only if those groups interact in certain ways. So what we're really interested in is helping teams and organizations and leaders know how to create the conditions for group genius so that the organization can outperform itself and continuously change. And that's what we're up to helping people know how to do.
And I love you using the term allergic, because that's perfect. I think it just describes it perfectly, in that no one likes to be told what to do. In fact, if it's perceived that way, then you have a slight chance it's going to make any change. So allergic, I love the word. Now, in your organization, Deeper, Funner Change, you've given your teammates non-traditional job titles, like yours, which is Secret Weapon, and others include Elephant Whisperer, Force for Good, Extreme Collaborator, Leadership Anthropologist, and more. What is your strategic intention with these titles, and how did you come up with them?
Oh my goodness, I think if I had my whole Deeper, Funner crew here on the phone with you, Steve, we would hear you ask about strategic intention, and we'd probably all be looking at each other and thinking, oh, was there a strategic intention there? we did ask ourselves, and we ask ourselves at every step, how is it that we can live the values of group genius in the way that we're organizing ourselves? Because we're kind of like a little test case or a little incubator for our own ideas, as well as learning from our clients and working with our clients. And one of the things that was clear to us is that traditional titles like managing director or senior principal, they might tell someone about the span of responsibility, and they will certainly tell you something about the amount of clout that someone has within an organizational group. But what was more interesting to us was to ask, what is the value that each person is actually bringing? We have Leslie, who is the force for good, and she does work in a traditional, or you, I guess you would think of her, if you were thinking in traditional terms, as our managing director. Her job is to work as a force for good to help all of us as we're consulting do our best work. And she also does social sector work. So we really think of her as a force for good internally and externally. Secret weapon. And I do, I just love my title.
That's a great title. That's a great title.
And I didn't come up with it. That's one of the reasons I love it. One of my clients did. And they said, you know, you've been working with us for 6 years and we think of you as our secret weapon. And I was so delighted because to me, secret weapon is something that you bring in when your vision for yourself is beyond what you can figure out how to do in the moment. You get a little help to do it, but that help is kind of backstage. And the job of a secret weapon is to help you expand your capacity and to stay in the background. And that's how I think of my work with leaders and teams. So I love being a secret weapon. And Karen, we called her the elephant whisperer because she has this amazing talent of coming into a room and sensing what the level of emotion is in the room. Who feels psychologically safe? Who feels comfortable speaking out? And who doesn't? What are the dynamics? It's almost like she has X-ray vision and she can see them. So elephant whisperer comes from the social psychologist John Haidt's metaphor. Chip and Dan Heath also used the language in their book Switch, so you may have heard of it there. John Haidt talks about elephant and rider. The rider is the rational, logical brain, the prefrontal cortex. If you could see me right now, you'd see me gesturing to the front of my forehead. 170-pound rider riding on top of an elephant who thinks he's in charge. The elephant, which is the ancient brain, 3 to 4 million years old, sitting at the back and deep inside our skull. The ancient brain with its limbic system, the fight or flight system, and the sensing organs, the amygdala, that are constantly scanning the environment for threat. That elephant weighs 2 to 3 tons. And if the elephant doesn't like where the rider thinks it should go, the elephant's going to go tearing through the jungle and there is nothing that that little rider can do about it. So Karen is exquisite at coming into a room and sensing how everybody's elephants are doing, and then giving them what they need. So again, the titles really came from asking, what is the chief value that this person is bringing to the clients, or in the case of Leslie, to our organization as well as clients? And we have a lot of fun with them.
It reminds me that, you know, identifying with things you do is so important. I've told this story many times, and so I'll tell it again, but I went to see Seth Godin speak one time in Seattle. And he was talking about, you know, because people would always ask me, well, you're the CEO of this company. What do you do in your day to day? And I'm like, geez, what do I do? I mean, I'm on the phone. I answer emails. It's like so boring. I thought, is that really what I do? And then he was describing you need to identify with what you do. So he gave some ideas. And I went home and I really worked hard on what it was. And I figured out 3 things that I do. And now I tell people, they say, well, what do you do in your position? And I say, I'm an ambassador for the company, I'm a storyteller, and I help leaders grow. And that totally changed how I perceived my job. And every time I was answering an email or on the phone or in a meeting, I was saying, I'm doing one of these 3 things just in a different way. And to me, that really helped me identify with what my purpose was in my position. So I wholeheartedly applaud your titles and what they mean, because I do think they just give inspiration in a different non-traditional way that is exciting and not boring, if you will.
I needed to pick up on that for a moment, Steve. If I think back to our work together at Therapeutic Associates and the Hot House Project, You actually shared with me once early on that you thought one of your purposes as the CEO was to grow other leaders. And I was so struck by that that I used that in every one of our initial sessions. Each year, I would talk to the Hot House cohort, sharing your words with them and inviting them to think of themselves not just as doers, as people who worked in their businesses and in the business, but working on the business. And one of their biggest responsibilities was helping leaders grow, growing other leaders. That came directly from you. People really, it was really a frame shift for them in terms of how they thought about their roles.
Yeah, it makes a difference. And since we're telling real life stories here and getting a little vulnerable, tell me a little bit about that first cohort you had at TAI. What was it like, and what did you find?
Yeah, three things come to mind right away when you ask that question. Two of them are kind of embarrassing, and one of them changed how I think about change and working with leaders forever. The two that are kind of embarrassing are these. I remember in one of the first few hours, we had, you'd done a great job of getting a really diverse group of TAI leaders to make up that first cohort. And I think you'd been really smart because you had some younger leaders, you had some newer clinic directors, you had a couple of people from the executive team, and you had some of the more established directors that were also shareholders in the company and had a lot of credibility internally. And I think you might have had one or two contradictorians too, just to see, how they might take to the program. So one of the folks who was in our program, one of the leaders, was the mutual friend that had introduced us to begin with. And he's someone I had known for decades. And he and I lived together in our early 20s. We rented rooms in a house. And we always had a bit of a battle because he liked the temperature really low and I liked it really high. And he used to get really frustrated with me because I would come in and he'd have all the windows open and it would be 55 degrees inside and he'd been ex be exercising and I would close all the windows and turn the heat up to 80. Well, in the middle of one of our first hours with that very first cohort, somebody said something and he chimed in and said, "Oh yeah, you better watch out or she'll turn the temperature up to 80." And I swore at him as if we were still housemates years ago. It's like I just completely lost the fact that I was facilitating a group of leaders and I swore at him. And there was this dead silence, and then everybody cracked up because I'm not sure they'd actually heard anyone swear at him in public before. The second thing that was kind of embarrassing and also hilarious is that, as you know, one of the things we did with that cohort and with many of our leadership programs was begin during day one by giving people a firsthand experience of what it's like to co-create change, to adapt in the moment as a group when the stakes feel kind of high. And it top-down command and control doesn't work. And the way we would do that is by bringing in an improv teacher, improvisational theater teacher. And the teacher had the group for 2.5 hours and prepared them to give a live performance in a theater to a live audience. So, mid-afternoon on the first day of the year-long Hot House project, I would tell people we wanted to give them a firsthand experience of this way of working and that there were multiple other disciplines that had mastered this way of working. Like the people who work aircraft carriers in the ocean, they work together, co-creating and adapting in the moment to achieve results, and life hangs in the balance. Firefighters work together in this way, in this group genius way. Emergency medical technicians do it. And another group of people, business people, are not people historically who have really refined this way of working, but another group are improv troops, and that it was just too expensive to helicopter everyone out to an aircraft carrier, and we thought it was too dangerous and would be too much of a hit on TAI's liability insurance if we set something on fire and invited some fire people. So we hired an improv instructor, and that 2.5 hours later, there was going to be a live audience waiting to see a troupe of improvisers perform, and that this group of TAI leaders was that improv troupe. So here's the thing that happened. They didn't believe me. There's this sort of silence. All the air gets sucked out of the room. And then the improv instructor walks in the door and immediately takes charge and starts getting them warmed up. Well, on the walk from where we held our leadership sessions to the theater where they were going to perform, I noticed that one member of the cohort was getting farther and farther and farther behind. And I started to get kind of nervous. And in the last block, he actually walked off the sidewalk and through a parking lot winding between the cars. And I just thought, is this guy going to make it or not? And should I go talk to him or should I just let him, you know, choose his path? And we got to the front door of the improv theater and I held the door open as people filed inside. And I waited and I waited and I waited. And sure enough, he got there to the door and he walked in. And he said afterwards that the only reason that he made it all the way to the theater and actually walked through that door was that he couldn't stand the thought of the humiliation that he would have to endure with his peers if he hadn't had the guts to get up on stage.
Oh my gosh.
So I love that too.
And the thing that amazes me about that, I was going to say technique, but maybe strategy, whatever you call it, was how the cohorts always kept that secret. So the next year's cohort and the next year's, for literally 10 years, no one ever knew that was going to happen. So it was a surprise to those people every year. I thought that was amazing.
I just give full credit to those cohort members. I can't believe they kept it quiet.
Yeah, that's awesome. And then you said the third part. So those were the two that were embarrassing. And then there was one that you said was enlightening, I think you said.
I did. You know, one of the things that you told me when you first asked about creating this program together, you told me that you knew healthcare was changing. You just didn't know how it was going to change. There was no crystal ball that could show how healthcare was going to change, but you knew there was radical change coming. And you said, I just need our leaders and our teams to be change ready. So because of that, a third of the year was always dedicated to how you help lead your team and create the conditions for the entire team to co-create change. And each cohort member designed their own project, something that was business critical, timely, that would benefit from having their whole team involved, and something that they knew they didn't have the answer for on their own. And they had 3 months to execute on their change challenge. And I'll never forget this. Kelly Reed, one of our cohort members, just an extraordinary leader, she was a shareholder and was also working with the shareholders to explore the current compensation program at the company and whether or not it was still serving your purposes or needed to be evolved. And she took on as her project, using the techniques that we were using together around Group Genius to help the shareholders at TAI revisit and reinvent what compensation looked like. And she blew my mind. It was the most ambitious project that anyone in her cohort took on. And she was so thoughtful about how she used the different techniques, meeting facilitation techniques, a way to hear all voices, sharing responsibility within the group, but having a very clear decision process, and really helped people through a facilitated process share what their concerns were and what benefits they saw to different models. And it just absolutely blew me away. And what I got really clear about then is that leadership learning happens in the process of the real work. It definitely doesn't happen in the offsite or in the leadership program. It's when you go back and you're applying what you're doing with your real people, because that's where you earn your stripes. You learn what works and what doesn't. You've got the most on the line, but also where you start to shift culture. And shifting the culture of an organization is intimately related to growing the leadership of an organization. So anyway, she's my teacher. It's amazing.
Yeah, Oh, Kelly's amazing. She is amazing. And I can remember that first cohort, I had to twist some arms big time to go into it because they weren't sure and what are we doing and whatever. And just as a credit to you and to them of how deeply they embraced it, that a couple years later, I was having people begging me to get into the next cohort. So it really did have an impact. And for context for our listeners today, we should say this was a year-long program that started with a 2-day retreat and then a meeting for one full day once a month for an entire year, and there were like 12 people in the cohort. So it was a great program, and we called it Hot House, or you called it Hot House. And was that a name that you had used before, or was that specific to that group?
I'd used it once before when I had initially tried to bring a group of leaders together to learn some core skills. Because probably in the, oh, I don't know, maybe the 5 years before I met you and you and I started working together, or before we had that first conversation, I had noticed that my clients were asking for the same things again and again. Help us navigate conflict productively. Help us learn how to grow the people on our team, to delegate effectively and effectively mentor and coach them into new capacities. And then help us figure out how on earth to manage change. And so, because those requests were coming again and again, I just thought, let's put all this together. Let's put these three things together that are really knocking at leaders' doors across organizations, across sectors. And let's create an environment and an experience that's very fertile for learning how to do those three things as a leader or create the conditions for them. And I just use the British word hothouse, like a greenhouse. You know, it's an environment that's very fertile. And you notice it's very warm inside too. I guess that's the theme.
There you go. You get back to the warm. Perfect. So, with so much investment in leadership development by companies, why do you think it is often doesn't give the companies the ROI that they're looking for?
I have a theory. I have a hunch about that. We do it deeper, funner. I'll share my hunch. And then, Steve, I want to hear yours because you've really been out there on the ground leading teams and organizations beautifully for years. So I really want to hear your voice on this too. Here's how we think about it. And I referred to this a little bit earlier. If you think of your organization as a fishbowl and the fish or the people inside, the water that they're swimming in is the culture, you know, and it's that water that is the sort of invisible goo between us that represents the expectations we have. You know, my expectations and beliefs about how you'll respond if I don't meet a deadline, or if I speak up about a different opinion I have, or share a concern, bring bad news. That's the water we're swimming in. And then the fishbowl itself, we think of as the structures and the processes, whether it's your performance review process or the structure of your executive meeting or how you hold organizational goals and you know, move those forward over time in a year or 3 or 5. Those are the structures. And what we observe as we look back at leadership development, and heck, I look back at the first 15 years of my career. I did this too, so I can talk about it. All leadership development was geared towards reaching inside the fishbowl, plucking out your high potential fish, sending them away to a leadership development program, and then plopping them back down without any additional support or work, and expecting that not only in the same water, with the same other fish and the same shape of the fishbowl, we would expect that they would swim differently. They'd swim the new way they've been taught and magically get all the other fish swimming in a new way. What we see about that is if you want the fish to be swimming in a different way, you also have to shift the water and their expectations of each other and their patterns together. And you have to shift the shape of the fishbowl. And the way to do that is not just to pull out high potential fish, but to have those high potential fish have real life experiences with the other fish where they're interacting and getting real results on real business issues with their other real fish. in a different way. That's what begins to shift the water. And then you also have, just like Kelly and the compensation patterns and the compensation program, that's a structure. So you have to think, okay, to be successful in the future, to have our fish swimming in a different way, how do we need to tweak our fishbowl so that we are supporting and inviting the behaviors that are going to make us successful? So I think that they haven't succeeded, or I think we've all put lots of good time and energy and money hoping that those little fish could come back in and make magic happen, when instead we needed to be actually engaging all three levels of the fishbowl at the same time. That's my thought.
No, I think that's great. And just to piggyback on that, I think from my perspective, you know, I've said it before, and I think I started out as a bit of a reluctant leader, because I'm a right brain thinker. And I think that everybody, not everybody, but I think a lot of businesses have been run by left brain thinkers. Very analytical, very, black and white. You do this, you do that, this is what you get and whatever. And I just don't think that way. And so I thought, gee, maybe I don't have the skills to do that. So what I did is I can remember in those early cohorts of the hothouses, the analytical people that were putting into the group would call me up and go, well, what's my return on investment? And I go, well, what do you mean? And they go, well, am I going to, you know, make more money? Am I going to be more efficient? Am I going to be able to do this better, that better? And I always said the same thing. I said, I have no idea, but the only thing I know is that you will change and you will be different. And how that works is how you embrace it, and how you your level of vulnerability, your level of going forward, and what that looks like, I don't know. It'll just be different. And for a left brain thinker, that freaks them out. For me, as a right brain thinker, that's exciting, because I'm going, I can't wait to see what happens. And so in previous interviews, I had the same discussion with Daniel Pink, and he said that he believes, as I do, that the future leaders is there's going to be a lot more right brain thinkers, because we finally figured out that humans with emotion and the way they approach things and feelings, numbers don't always work. And so we can't always, look at the ROI and say, oh, this is exactly what it's going to be. All I know is that if I invest time and energy into people and appreciate them and appreciate what they're saying, I think we'll have a better outcome. So that's hard to measure, but that's why people struggle with it sometimes. They're looking for the silver bullet, and it's just something that changes gradually when everyone's on board over time. And then you look back and you think, wow, look at what we've done, but it was hard to measure along the way.
Well, one thing I think too, because of your orientation, Steve, your openness and how relational you are, as CEO during that process, one of the things that you had the authority to do beautifully was to take some of the concepts and the, I would say, the strategies and the practices of Group Genius, and you began to influence others and yourself to bring them into different parts and structures of the organization. When I think, for example, about the annual leadership retreat that you supported for the organization, you had a big hand in really shifting what that large retreat looked like, where all the leaders, all the directors got together to work on issues and to share learnings each year. You started to apply some of what we were using in Hothouse to that process. And as that started to happen, that really changed. That was a change to the fishbowl and a change to the water that started to, I think, make exponential the impact that the Hothouse leaders did.
And I think that's so true. And really, what really happened there was realizing that myself as the leader, and maybe a couple other people standing up front of a group and talking for 2 or 3 days, was not near as effective as getting 20 people involved to present their piece of their world to the rest of us. And it was just so much better when we did it that way. And and like you say, you learn as you go, because at first I thought, well, I'm the leader, I've got to do this. And I thought I was doing a pretty good job of handling the leadership retreat. But the way I did it at the beginning compared to when I, right before I retired. So tell us about, now I understand that you worked with a company. Is it Malum or Malum? How do you say that?
Oh, it's company? Malum Architects. Malum.
So tell me about that, the first time you facilitated their retreat.
Just even thinking about that, actually, my face goes red and I feel a little like, oh, feeling in the pit of my stomach. I should say that Malam is an extraordinary group of architects, and they are doing beautiful work trying to shift equity and access to opportunity within communities through the process of building new buildings and engaging the community and the way they build them. And way back in the day, this is years ago now, they asked me if I would come and facilitate the first group strategic planning session. Malam's an old firm, but they had a history of really having the CEOs being the ones who determined what the strategy was and what the goals were going to be. And there was a very enlightened CEO, like yourself, Steve, who was about to step into his CEO role. And he was really clear, he's like, I don't have the visionary ideas, but wow, the next generation of leaders, they have a lot of great ideas, and they're the ones who are going to need to lead us into the future. So why don't we invite them to be part of this strategic planning process? So great premise. And I was really honored, and I was in business school at the time, and they were my first client. And so I went up to a beautiful retreat center in Washington State with all of them. And we had a 2-day retreat, and I was really pretty much working just like using book learning at that point. I'd read tons of books in my MBA program, and I had some ideas from different people about what a strategic planning retreat could look like. And I'm about to give facilitators a bad name because I had people spread out over the room. They were trying to, I gave them spaghetti and pipe cleaners and marshmallows and glitter. And I said, create a vision of the future. And it was kind of a disaster. We ended up having all of this, it looked like a kindergarten room, all kinds of materials out and around the room. And they had a good time and they left at the end of day one. And I stayed back to clean up the room. And I thought to myself, I have no idea how the heck we are going to turn all these pipe cleaners and pieces of spaghetti into a real vision and strategy for the company. I do not know where to go from here. And then I had this thought that I've only had once in my life, in my professional life. I literally thought, Steve, I could just get in my rental car and drive.
Bail.
And not be here tomorrow.
Yeah. Oh gosh. Well, we all learn, don't we?
It was a scary moment. And what really happened was then I joined them over dinner and I just listened really carefully to their conversation. And as I listened to their conversation about the day, about what resonated, about what didn't, about what questions were on their minds, it became really clear to me what we needed to solve for. And I learned my lesson. I'm actually a big fan of pipe cleaners and spaghetti and marshmallows, but man, you have to be really clear about how the process that you're using is moving the group towards what it is they're trying to create and keep making that link. So I learned my lesson then to make sure I was super clear about that.
Yeah, it reminds me, I was in an executive staff meeting and we were doing some planning and I was going through, this exercise and I just started stumbling over myself and it became awkward. And my CFO looked at me and she said, Steve, how can we help you now? And I'm like, and I looked at her and I said, I don't know. And she said, how about a break? And I said, good idea. So it's like, oh my gosh. So we all, it's never perfect. That's for sure.
What's so great about that story is I think the teams that have each other's back in that way, who aren't like, she obviously wasn't, sitting back with her arms crossed, waiting to see if you succeeded or failed. Instead, she saw the value of what you were trying to do. And she was like right in there to try and help you do it to benefit the team. And that's a team.
That's very true. If everyone says that they want better and more transparent communication, why is it that so many people struggle with that?
I mean, this is a great question to be asking. I could quote some studies or talk theory, but probably the answer lives in us. if you and I, just for a moment, pretend we're not doing an interview, we're just having a conversation over a glass of wine. Think about it. You don't have to tell me the specific conversation, but think about a conversation that you knew had your name on it. And I'll do the same. And it felt hard to step into. What was it that made it feel so hard? What were we each afraid of?
I mean, if you're asking me, I mean, I think it often comes back to being exposed or being, you know, the kind of the imposter syndrome or, you know, somebody saying, oh my God, I can't believe he doesn't know that or something, you know, something along those lines is why we tighten up sometimes.
Tighten up. That's good. When I think about the last couple of, you know, tough conversations that have had my name on them, one thing that I know has had me tightening up was that I felt a lot of frustration with the other person. And I really cared about the relationship. Like I wanted to, we were friends and colleagues, and I wanted to continue having a strong friendship and colleagueship. I didn't want to lose that. And I, especially because I felt so much frustration, anger, I was afraid that by having the conversation with them, I would alienate them, hurt the relationship. And because I was so mad, this is really kind of funny. I think I was afraid that the anger would leak and hurt our relationship. So I think those are the kinds of things that people are afraid of. Like some of it is biology. How sensitive are we? How attuned are our mirror neurons to the stress and suffering and anger of other people? That can have an impact. Our biography, how did our first families handle conflict and tension? Because we sure learned patterns from them to try and reduce the tension or escape it. And that just, you know, ends up creating kind of a complex and unique algorithm inside us that is constantly calculating, if I step in to have this difficult conversation, I think these things might happen. Good outcome or bad outcome.
So what is the most impactful thing that you can do to help people get to that open level of communication you just described?
What a good question. Honestly, what's coming to mind is to give them an experience of stepping into a conversation where there's heightened risk and they survive. That then begs the question, what's the scaffolding? What support do they need to be able to step into a conversation that's just a little scary, that has them tightening up just a little bit, not their biggest, most contracted conversation, but a little bit of a tightening. And I think the things that we see make a difference are they're sort of multi-layered. So having a good conversational recipe that you can use that has some intelligence baked into it. I like to use the experience wheel a lot. Originally it was the experience cube, I think, in Jervis Bush of Clear Leadership. That was his book. He's up at Simon Fraser University. This was his model initially. When you feel tension in a situation, first to identify what you see, what are the facts and the data, so clean, so non-judgmentally that you could say them and you'd have the other person nodding their head. They see the same things. They see the same data too. And then simple one word, what do you feel? I feel frustrated. I feel concerned. I feel, you just have to avoid the D word, disappointment. You can't say disappointment. That gets too much parental projection. At one point, everybody heard their parents say they were disappointed in them. And then the story in my head, and tell them what your hunch is or your wild fantasy about what might be going on. And then I want to understand what's happening for you. And I want us to figure out how we are going to close the books next month, even or better, and not in the red the way we have the last 2 months, or whatever the issue is. State your intention, including your desire to hear the other person's perspective. 8 times out of 10, they've got new information for you or they've been thinking about things differently, or they have a different fantasy in their head about how things are supposed to go, or what they expected from you, or what you expected from them. But having a conversational recipe like that, you can hear using a conversational recipe forces you to clean up your act before you step into the conversation and increase your own self-awareness. Because if you have to start with clear facts and data, whatever you see, that means you have to make sure that you do have data, that there's evidence of a problem. It's not just their style drives you bonkers.
Yeah, I think what you just described there very well gets kind of back to that left brain, right brain thing we were talking about. You, as someone who's done a lot of research and read so much and studied the literature and really understand the left brain side of these conversations and how they should go and what happens and whatever, is all very important. But the experience of being on the right side of the brain and experiencing that interaction and having it go, you know, well or not so well, but that experience is really what makes it work. And so combining those two, I think, really, really makes a difference. Because you can read research studies and analytics and whatever till the cows come home, but till you experience it in your being, it doesn't have the impact.
I remember when I first started using that particular conversational recipe. And of course, again, each part of that recipe requires you to learn and become self-aware. And it's the learning and the self-aware, becoming more self-aware, that also sets you up for the conversation well. But the first time I tried to use that, because I used to have a really hard time with conflict and tension, I used it with a Subaru dealer because I had taken my car back to have the wheels rotated. And on the way home, a hubcap had come flying off. And I'd gone back and gotten a new hubcap put on. And the second time, a hubcap came flying off. And so I went back again and I used that conversational recipe, because by that time I was steamed. I was just sure there was somebody back there in the shop that wasn't doing their job. And I got halfway through that little recipe, which should take about 60 seconds. And the dealer interrupted me with all kinds of reasons that it wasn't their fault. And he got quite angry. And so I got really small and I just said, okay, thanks. All right. And I just left and got in my car and drove away with three hubcaps. And I was so mad at myself. And then I thought, okay, great. Well, now I calibrated. Now I know where I am. And it's only up from here in terms of my skill in these conversations.
Yeah, that's great. I love the term how you said collaborative intelligence. So how do you cultivate collaborative intelligence?
Yeah, it's a mouthful. That's why we default to group genius a lot.
Yeah.
You know, but both you and I are relentless learners. And one of the things that I did over the last 10 years was take a little scenic turnout and go into a doctoral program. While I was in the doctoral program, I had a chance to study an organization that went from top-down command and control to radically collaborative. They also went from 30 people and struggling to grow to 100 people full-time, swelling to 450 three times a year during their high season. And it's Tasty Catering. They're comfortable with me using their name. They were named America's psychologically healthiest organization by the American Psychological Association. And both Forbes and Inc. magazine named them as one of America's top 25 small businesses. So these guys have got creds across the room in terms of what they've been able to achieve through a new way of working. So I had a chance to spend about a year and a half studying them. And three things rose to the top. I interviewed people from all over the organization, asking them to tell me the stories of when change happened, when the organization started to shift to its newer and more successful way of working. And there were these three drivers that kept showing up across the stories. And the first one was that they were all learning animals. So the organization expected, or came to expect, wasn't that way to begin with, came to expect everyone to always have something they were working on, something they were trying to get better at. They advertised those goals with each other, and they coached up, down, and sideways. So they learned to coach each other and they just coached all over the place. They had a very feedback-rich culture, very transparent. Everyone was always learning. They were always taking on stretch assignments. They were always asking each other for help. And they were very transparent about failures, not because failures are good or desired, but because they felt the only failure was not to learn from the failure. So everything was transparent and people shared their failure stories everywhere so that other departments wouldn't have to suffer the same challenges. So they were learning animals. Second thing that was going on there was they had structures that were designed to help people co-create new solutions to problems. For example, and this was probably most impressive, they didn't have a regular leadership team meeting. Instead, they had a council. And the council, they called it the Good to Great Council because they've been really influenced by Jim Collins' work through his book, Good to Great. The council had a representative from every team in the organization. And those representatives were not necessarily the leaders. Most of them weren't the formal team leads. And that council got together once a month to work on an issue or a problem or a question that was of strategic importance to the organization. Some of them were operational as well. And the job of each representative was to take the question in advance of the meeting to their team to do a tour de table, turn-taking, so to kind of pass the mic to hear from each individual team member their best thinking about the problem or the question. Then the representative had to bring the thinking of their team back to the council. The council then went, they passed the mic, they went one person at a time and heard the perspective of each team on the issue or the challenge. And then they had open discussion, spurred by the question, what are our next wise actions to up the likelihood of success in the face of this for all teams? And they came up with some extraordinary solutions. And you know, you had people who were working in the driving department for the catering part of their business, coming up with solutions for the marketing team. Just brilliant. So they had those very structured meetings and they had many other structures like that, that helped people step away from their normal tendencies. Like in a meeting, I speak up and take a lot of airspace, or in a meeting, I hang back and I hear what other people have to say and I wait till I'm asked. You know, they created the structure of one person at a time, representative, structured dialogue to help them develop more co-created solutions that would be better for the business and informed by everyone's perspectives. So they use those kinds of structures that they'd invented themselves all over the organization. And then the last thing that they did was they very, very deliberately, we were talking about conflict, this comes back to conflict. They very deliberately had a value, which was treat all people with respect. And that value for them meant if we have tension between us, if you feel disrespected by something I've done, it's your duty, and actually you're a hero for coming and calling it out to me, because that's what's going to help us improve our system, including improve our relationship. And you are not a hero if you keep it to yourself. So they developed this way of working with each other. This treat all with respect was their language for what I call have each other's backs and develop psychological safety. So each individual, quite apart from how they were performing, felt deeply respected as a human being and deeply seen as worthwhile as a human being. So they had those three things, those three drivers going in everything they did. Every solution they came up with represented those three, had elements of those three.
And I think that segues brilliantly into my next question, which I was going to ask you. What predicts higher performance, a group of superstars or a well-functioning team of collaborators? I think that probably is easy to answer with the story you just told of the company that had a lot of collaborators.
That is my belief. The research shows us that, well, we know people, humans, come together in groups to do things that they can't do on their own. The research shows us, Thomas Malone's first work out of MIT shows us that a group of people can outperform even the smartest individual within them, but only if they're interacting in certain ways, in those ways that Tasty does. It's pretty fascinating stuff.
Describe what you mean, because I've heard you say this before. Describe what you mean by yes and habits.
Right. Well, you know, and I've mentioned improv already. Some of my background is in improvisational theater. Yes and is many people are probably familiar with. It's one of the core practices in improv. And yes and does not actually mean that we have to agree with each other. It's not about acquiescing. Yes and means this. Whatever you bring to the table, first I'm going to yes it. Again, not by agreeing with it necessarily, but by recognizing the reality of it. That's your perspective. Yes, I see that. And then I'm going to add my perspective to it in a way that builds on your idea. And adding my perspective could be saying, yes, and my biggest concern about that is blank. How do you think about that, Steve? And then we're into a very generative conversation that's going to get us somewhere better. So yes and habits are the very opposite of debate and decide. Debate and decide is kind of binary. It's like you're right or you're wrong, you win or you lose. Yes and believes that the perspective that each person is bringing to the table has some value. And by deeply listening to each other's perspectives and then keeping the problem we're trying to solve in mind, if we put elements of our different perspectives together, we will come to a radically better solution than any one of us could. So yes and means listening deeply, recognizing people's ideas, building on them, being willing to be changed by what you hear from others, and also being willing to take up your own voice around what you see is true or could be helpful, your own ideas. Does that help?
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. The list of clients you have worked with is impressive, including GE, Intel, Nike, Disney, just to name a few. And I would imagine both C-level executives and lower-level employees need to buy in to get the best results. Do you find that both groups are willing to do that work in some of those bigger organizations?
So when you say that work, do you mean to shift how they work to more of a collaboratively intelligent way?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the reason I asked the question is because, you know, if I'm in the C-level suite and I want all my people to do something a certain way, but I'm not willing to do that, then it's probably not going to fly. So it has to be organizationally the same, and you have to be willing to do that same hard work, changing the way maybe you've done things in the past for the betterment of the group.
I'll tell you a story, and this story is not my story. It's a story of a former colleague of mine, Gary Hirsch, when he and I worked together at a consultancy that we helped build many years ago. And I love this story. Gary was working with a team, a fairly senior team in an organization. And Gary was doing a warm-up with that group using an improv game. And one of the things that we know is that using improv games or anything that connects people and helps them focus and be learners together, be a little vulnerable, be authentic, take a little bit of a risk with each other, will increase the psychological safety in a group so that what they're able to do with the rest of the meeting will be enhanced. So Gary was leading one short improv warm-up with this senior team, and the leader of the team said, "This is stupid." And dead silence fell on the room. And all the team members stopped immediately and, you know, looked left and right, looked at the leader, looked at Gary, like, what the heck is going to happen now? And Gary said he had no idea what to do, but he just yes-anded the leader's offer. And he said, yeah, you know what? Some people feel that way about connecting as a group before getting to the content of what you're working on. That's okay. You go ahead and do what you need to do. The rest of us are going to continue playing. And he continued with the game. People were tentative at first, but then as they saw Gary was very confident and going to have a good time, they slowly engaged with more and more vigor. And the leader stood there for a moment, silent, an angry look on his face. And then he actually turned and left that part of the room, sat down at the other end of the room, and opened up his laptop. Fast forward a couple of hours, the leader rejoined the conversation when everyone else sat down. Slowly, he moved back over to where the group was and, you know, slowly got back into the conversation, the business work that they were doing. And over lunch, so this is the fast forward, over lunch, the leader did a really powerful thing. He actually stood up at the lunch table and got everyone's attention and said, "I owe you all an apology. I didn't like what we were doing. I didn't, when we were playing that game, I didn't see the value of it. I didn't see the purpose. And I was very worried about how we were spending our time, and I behaved badly." And watching the rest of you pick back up and continue to play, and then take that sense of camaraderie and ease and lightheartedness into the problem solving that we then had to do, taught me a really important lesson. And I apologize. And Gary was like, "Phew, wow, that turned out okay."
Yeah.
But I think, one thing I learned actually from Tasty Catering and from the CEO there is that the leader does not have to know how to lead the change. He or she does not have to be good at the new behaviors that are required for the change. They don't even have to be fully convinced that the change is needed. They just have to be willing to learn. And if they're willing to learn and be changed with their people and by their people, then magic can happen. Then buy-in, as you say, emerges from the process of learning together, doing things differently, and getting successes.
So well said. You know, in times like these, this interview is taking place during the COVID-19 crisis that we're all living through. Many companies cut back on staff and team development due to concerns over finances. That's very reasonable. What message should leaders hear about what to do during a crisis like this in relation to investing in their culture?
Wow, what a juicy question. That is a good question. Well, I've been heartened to see so much appearing in the blogosphere and the Twittersphere and the Mediumsphere about the importance for teams of staying connected, especially in times of stress, but definitely because we don't have ready visual or physical access to each other. Even for remote teams who are used to being remote are seeing each other and exposed to other human beings a lot less right now. Well, I've been really inspired to see so much out there about the importance of continuing to have structured meeting times where a team is together, continue with norms with each other that reinforce the kind of culture that you want and need, and to have super explicit, no surprise, co-creative conversations with the team. What do we need from ourselves and from each other in terms of how we work, how we meet, and how we communicate, so that we can continue to do our best work during this time? And that's not a one-time conversation. And I guess now we're getting to my perspective on it, which is, I think you really can't know what's going to work until you try it. And I've been most excited by some of our client teams that have had very explicit conversations with their teams. You know, what's creating drag for you? What's something new that you've tried that really works? What do we need from each other? Let's try that for 2 weeks. And then another conversation. How's it going? What are we noticing? What seems most important for us to pay attention to? What are our next wise actions? So I think it sounds like I may not be answering your question, but if what the team says, and I've had clients who've said this, if what the team says is, hey, we need to learn how to give feedback because it was a problem before, and now we're working remotely for who knows how long, it's even more important now. Then investing in that virtually is more important than ever. If the team says, actually, our priorities have changed, that was important, but now what's really important is that we do X, then pay attention to that and put the energy there.
Yeah, no, I think it's really interesting because I've thought a lot about this, and I've hesitated to say this because it sounds very self-serving. As you know, now I'm an executive coach. Finances are tough, revenues are weighed down, we've got to cut expenses, and often that leadership development or that that world that you and I live in all the time, it's time to say, okay, let's cut back on that because we can't really afford to do that right now. But I also think of the question in my mind as, gosh, might be the most important time ever to have that mentorship, that coaching, that keep your team together and get to a higher level of performance and all that. But it does take time and money, and I think that's the balancing act that leaders are in right now. And it's not an easy answer, and I surely don't profess that I know the answer. But I think it's just an interesting thing to think about. Is maybe investing time and money now in those areas help you get to the other side in much better shape than if you wait until you're secure again before you start that back up.
You know, something we've been experimenting with some of our clients is, and again, our brilliant clients have named this thing, reverse proposals. Knowing that finances are tight, people are nervous about what's coming because there's so much uncertainty. We're not all sure how this is going to evolve or impact the business and the bottom line. We've been talking to clients about projects. And then when they say, how much would that cost? We would say, well, in a non-COVID-19 world, this would be our fee for what we're talking about here. But what we'd like to do is say, we know we're in a COVID-19 world. It's a very uncertain world right now. We'd like to ask you to go away and come back to us with a proposal and let us know what investment feels right-sized for your team or organization right now that puts some skin in the game, helps us stay whole so we're partners in this, and also feels doable and not stressful for you. And I had one client, and I just loved this. One client decided the way to do that was for the four leaders that were spearheading the project to actually take their hourly rate and take an average of it. And that's what they offered us for facilitation, which I just thought was kind of brilliant. So anyway, I think there are lots of creative ways you can think about
that's it. That's awesome. Yeah, I love that because we all have to be willing to give, sacrifice as everyone else is. We can't expect, well, this is my fee, this is what I do, and take it or leave it. You know, there needs to be some creativity because how we did it before isn't necessarily how it's going to be done afterwards. We have to be willing to see our jobs and our positions differently in the future. So when we think about deeper, funner change, what does success look like to you?
Okay, so I'm going to answer that on two levels. First level is, and I feel a little self-conscious saying this out loud because it sounds a little self-serving. We had one client that we worked with who took on a strategic planning project with us. And one of their aims was to come out with a plan that included a plan for how they would distribute responsibility throughout the organization, because they'd had a pretty tightly held founder and senior team decision-making authority structure prior, that they wanted to really be growing the next generation. So they wanted a strategic plan to include a plan for how to distribute responsibility throughout the organization in a new way. And we said, well, why don't we use the creation of the strategic plan as a way to distribute responsibility. Let's involve a larger group of people in creating the strategy moving forward. So basically, let's begin as you wish to end, or begin as you wish to go on. And what it was a fabulous project, fascinating project, lots of ups and downs for everyone, some nerve-wracking moments, ultimately very successful. And our client said to us, this is my answer to you, Steve, you're so patient. My client said to us, when we first started working with you, we were pretty sure we'd come out of this with a really good strategic plan, but we had no idea that the DNA of our organization would transform.
Wow, that's powerful.
I thought it was. And you know, that's what they were talking about when you shift from this sort of tightly held leadership authority and responsibility to more distributed responsibility. There's so many benefits, and it is a transformation of your DNA. So That to me was success.
That's awesome. Well, Julie, usually at this time of the interview, I always kind of start to close things up by asking this question. So what would be in relationship to leadership, what would your pearl of wisdom be for our listeners today?
Steve, I think we've surfaced it with your good questions. That saying, which comes from my collaborator, Karen Dawson, that people are allergic to being told what to do, but they wholeheartedly embrace what they've helped create. I think that's my pearl. If you remember nothing else, remember that. And different things will start to happen.
Well, Julie, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time with us today. As usual, I just get so inspired and so excited to talk with you because your brain's an amazing thing. I love to pick at it and hear what's in there. So thanks so much for sharing that. I will say one other story that I want to acknowledge publicly here is that, as you remember, when I was had not retired yet, I was still CEO of TAI, and I had lunch with you, and you asked me what I wanted to do in my next life. And I told you that I wanted to have an interview series, and I wanted to talk to people, and I wanted to do it on video was the original idea, and then also as a podcast, and you advised me. And I remember what you told me. You said, just realize that you'll get better and better as you do it, so don't necessarily do your big guns right out of the gate. So the first interview I ever did was Rich Cates, who was on my executive team, and I figured if I really screwed up, he would understand because he knew me so well. So he was my first one, and maybe this is why you're my 66th interview, because you're a big gun, and I waited and waited before I did you. So thank you for that advice, and thank you for just being who you are, and I've learned so much from you. I just feel like we're connected at a deep level, and thanks for the impact you've had, not only on my company, but my personal life. So I want to thank you very much for that.
Steve, I could talk with you all day. Thank you so much for the opportunity to spend some time with these compelling questions.
Okay, and good luck with the getting through the crisis, and I'm sure we're all going to come out on the other side, and it'll be exciting to see what we've learned through this and as we keep going and keep evolving. So take care. Have a great rest of your year, and hopefully we'll come out good on the other side.
Thank you, Steve. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To listen to all my interviews, subscribe to Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and many other popular podcast platforms. Some of these interviews are on video, and you can search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also access the entire library of interviews on my website, orange.coaching.com, and that is orange.coaching.com, and go to the Media Center and click on Podcasts or Video Gallery. You can also enter the website from pilpodcast.com.